Well, Martha and I count this a real privilege to be here. We look forward for some time to come to Dallas, especially to see Bob and Dee, as we kind of count them as our kids and their kids as our grandchildren. So it's a real thrill to be here. We hadn't expected this because I told Bob that we were on vacation and this was supposed to be a resting place for a couple of days before we go on to the International Convention of Christian Businessmen in Philadelphia. But I'm happy to share my personal testimony with you because I feel that the Lord, not because I deserve it, but the Lord has led in a very miraculous way in my life. As most of you know, I was born in Russia, in Omsk, Siberia. And the average American, when he hears of Siberia, thinks of Siberia like the average European thinks of the United States, only backwards. I mean, when you people think of Siberia, you think of salt mines and slave labor and those type of things. When we in Europe think of the United States, we think of money and wealth and ease and comfort and those things. Well, the place, of course, Siberia being a real large country, has got salt mines and it's got labor, slave labor and those things, and the mostly prisoners. But the part of the country where we lived was very pleasant. If you've been around Ashtabula, Ohio, I think that's the name of it. Why, that's about the way the country looked where we lived. We raised grain and cattle, and it was very fertile and very profitable. I come from a Mennonite background. That is, I am Mennonite, but Mennonite is not a nationality like so many people think. It's a denomination, a church denomination, and very much like the Baptists in their belief. Some peculiarities, one of the peculiarities that we had in Russia at least, is the fact that all our services were in German. We had them in German in this country until 1941, but I think since 1941 there are very, very few that are in German. In Canada, still some of them are in German, but in this country, they're all in English now. The fact that the services were in German and we spoke German at home, that is, and at home we spoke Holland Dutch, but in schools it was German, naturally kept us separated, and we lived in communities, Mennonite settlements, they called them over there. My father and mother met in a Mennonite settlement like that in the southern part of Russia near the Crimea. They went to Siberia on their honeymoon. They liked it so well that they stayed, convinced my grandfather and all of his children to move. And as it was custom in those countries, grandfather came over there and bought a big piece of land, and then he built a great big home. And all the kids lived in the home even though they were married until they had a chance to go on their own. Another thing that is completely different than here is we don't live on our land like you do at farming here, but we live in a village, and then we go out to farm the land away from home. And many times when we were planning or making ready the land, we would go away on Monday morning and come home on Saturday night, live out, sleep under the wagons and have Dad and someone else prepare the meals, and it was real fun, especially for a kid. My father and mother had a rather rough start because they were married in 1914.
She's going to get a crick in the neck. Why don't you go ahead and move to me and turn around. Excuse me, I have a feeling for you there.
Good.
Bob, if you were to flip that switch of that light back there with
the
see? Yeah.
See, they were married in 1913, and the war, of course, started in 1914. And so my dad spent, and the revolution started in 1919, so my dad spent the first 6 or 7 years of his married life either in the service or trying to stay out of it. And So it was a completely different setup than supposed to be. But anyway, I remember when we moved into our own home for the first time, until then having lived with Grandpa and Grandma and having just one room, which was my folks's. And they had a community kitchen, and there were three brothers and two sisters, and they were all married, and they all lived in this home with Grandpa and Grandma. And of course, they were little youngsters, but they were all little, as I was one of the oldest ones. And it was rather a unique bringing up. My grandfather had retired when he came there, so he and Grandma were just more or less supervising things that were going on. All of the operations, you have to remember that this is about 40 years ago. We had no mechanical things. It was all with horse and buggies and milking cows, and all the operations were that way. All of our farming was raising grain, and we used the John Deere drill to drill the land. We used a McCormick Deering self-binder to harvest. We had a McCormick Deering plow, and I remember those things that we used. And of course, the power was provided by horses. Every boy and girl, I believe, looks forward to that type of a job the first time. At least I know I could hardly wait until Dad would let me drive the horses to sow the wheat, and then drive the horses to harvest the wheat. The first year, or the first week, I shall say, that was a lot of fun. Afterwards, that became work. But I remember that from the time that I was 6 years old, it was my job to ride the horses, and when we did the harvesting and when we did the sowing. As we lived in villages, in our village, there were probably 15 families, and we would group together to sow as well as harvest our crops, so it was always kind of a community operation. We had all of the families from my dad's side, the four families, were operating together. We would pool our horses and pool our equipment, and we would sow one person's things first, and then the next one, and the next one, and then harvest the same way, and thrash it the same way. We used to have an old steam engine to provide the power to do the thrashing, and we had the machine set up in the yard, and then would haul the wheat or barley or oats, whatever it was, in from the fields. And of course, that was kind of a thrill for a kid to have, be able to drive the long wagon with a load of bundles of grain to the machine, and then unload them and take the next horse load and go out and get another load. And there was no manual labor to it, which was okay. The education part, which made the big change in our lives, was education, was handled by private tutor. All the parents in this village hired a teacher, and grandfather provided a room in his big home, and that's where we had our classes. We had from 18 to 25 youngsters, and the grades ran from 1 through 6. After the 6th grade, then we had to go on to high school, which was away from home. The teacher, in our particular case, lived... was provided a room, but then he ate at all of the parents' places. And so one month he was at our house, and another month he was at another house for maybe 2 weeks. Anyway, he was there for three meals a day, and so it was real close contact, not only in school, but also at home with a teacher. Of course, only having 16 to 25 students, depending on the years, we had close contact, even though he had to teach all the sixth grades. One of the things that, of course, the parents insisted on was that he was to be a Christian, and we used as our textbook, all of our textbooks were written by Christian people. All our reading was done from Christian books, that is, as far as the outside reading was concerned. The history setup was from the church history standpoint, so we had a good basic Christian training in our education. One of the first things that I remember was the revolution, which came to our part of the country in 1920. That's when the communists took over Russia. The things that I remember are gruesome, because those are the things evidently that impress upon themselves on young people. One of the first things I remember was the fact that when the white army, which was the army in power, came through, they of course wanted to mobilize all the people and all the power, horses for transportation and the equipment that they could. And in order to escape them, it wasn't a regular draft setup, it was another, they just caught them as they could. In order to escape them, the men folks would disappear, and my dad, for instance, let his beard grow, and he would come into the house like a stranger. We didn't dare say dad, and mother didn't act like he was her husband. He would just come in and maybe get something to eat and walk out, and he'd be gone for days and sometimes for a week. We didn't know where he was. When they left, of course, when the Red Army followed the White Army, it was even worse. They didn't make them transport a lot of things, and they would just simply say, well, now you have to haul these things from here to this next city, which may be 40 miles away by horse. In the wintertime, horse and sleds, and you never knew whether they would come back or not. It was a very trying time. Then when the communists finally did take over in 1920, it was a gruesome deal because they wanted to show authority, and so they really made things rough. And they arrested people for no apparent cause at all. My grandfather at that time was already past 60 years old. He hadn't worked for a good many years as far as physical work was concerned. He was arrested just because he was driving where he wasn't supposed to be. And he was put in jail and at hard labor for 6 months. He had to work on the hay baler. Like I said, he hadn't done any manual labor for a long time. Then the family had to provide food. They wouldn't feed him. They wouldn't allow any adults to bring him the food. And so we kids used to, twice a day, he was about 3 miles from us in a little Russian village where they made him work. We would have to bring food to him so that he might not starve to death. When they released him, due to the fact that he had been arrested and that he had been in jail, they confiscated 25% of everything that he owned. They just came into the house and they picked approximately what they thought was 25% of what he had, and that was it. Then they came in and they said that they won. There was a man in the community that they didn't think agreed with them, and they wanted to show us how they treated people that didn't agree with them. And they told my dad at night, they came by the window and they said that tomorrow morning at such and such a place, I want you to come with another man and pick up this man's corpse. So these two young fellows went out, picked this fellow up, he just lived a few doors from us, took him along to town, and then they had beheaded him during the night. Next morning at least, my dad and my uncle went over and got him. And evidently they'd asked him what he wanted to do as a last wish, and he must have said he wanted to pray because every one of his fingers were chopped off like that, which looked to us like he'd been wanting to pray. And it was just to impress people that they now had authority, and of course there was no law or order. After the communists did come in, however, the things became quite calm, especially since we were over about 3,000 miles away from Moscow, and the only transportation to our place was the railroad which goes from Moscow through to Vladivostok, a great Russian railroad, and we were just 3 miles from this railroad where we lived. We had just a moderate home. My father farmed a lot of land, but with the fact that he had been in the service so many years in a way, he hadn't made a lot of money. But we did have a lot of nice horses, and from the time I remembered, I always had a horse that I could call my own to ride. And before we left Russia, we had four thoroughbred racing horses that none of them that we were using for that, but that we would buy when they were colts, and then my dad would train them until they were about 3 years old and sell them in order to, just for a profit setup. But it gave a lot of extra activities for a young fellow that loved horses, and I wasn't in school too many years. My father was elected to a government position soon after the revolution to represent all of the farmers in an area of 50 miles around us, and there were four other Mennonite villages plus three Russian villages. And so he was the, in California at least, we'd call him a supervisor's job. Was the contact between the federal government at that time and these lay people. And because he was elected to this position, which had no pay, they would furnish him a secretary, and this secretary was supposed to be a communist. And he was a married man with, I think, four or five children. He lived in this town, which was about 3 miles from us, next to the railroad. And it became inconvenient for him to live there and work at our place. So he lived at our place during the week and just went home on weekends. Well, his salary was $25 a month. And he got that actually in rubles, but as far as ability to buy, you could buy with a Russian ruble at that time approximately what you could buy with a dollar, so the exchange would be about the same. And this fellow couldn't make a living on that, so he used to eat at our house, and then he not only that, but he took food along on the weekend, and before too long, we permitted him to sow some wheat and some barley and things there, and he was actually living more from us than he was from the government. And of course, they say that the way to a man's heart is through his stomach, and I think that the way to any man is through his stomach, so to speak. At least it wasn't too long before he actually became our friend rather than interested in what the communist people were doing. And it was a real advantage in the leading of the Lord in these things, because it gave us a lot of information that we would have never received had my father not been in this position and not contacted with these people. Because one of the first things that the communists did after they got established was to put up a program of education, and that it was to be government controlled rather than the way we were doing it, by hiring a private tutor. And I recall that I was in my fifth year at elementary school when the government came up with a very strong education program, that they were going to insist that we build public schools and that we use textbooks as furnished by the government. Now, of course, they didn't have any money, but they figured the people should build the buildings, and they gave them the opportunity. They made a survey, and they said, now, in your area, you're going to need so many schools, it's going to cost so much money, so why don't you raise this money in order to build these schools? Well, the people, like so many of them are doing in California right now, are voting down these tax issues, and so we did too. They didn't want to build the schools. They figured the schools that we had were good enough. Well, the government, in order to punish people and to teach them that they meant what they said, they would just say, well, if you feel that that is too much, you're just going to have to help your neighboring community, and we're going to just increase your quota of obligation to raise money. And they would, instead of maybe raising $20,000, you'd have to raise $40,000. And half of that, we're going to not even give to you, but all you're going to get is government bonds for it, and those bonds weren't worth the paper they were written on. In many of these communities, that was a means of trying to do what they were trying to do, and that is to equalize the people. Everybody, that's one of the big things of communism. You see that everybody is equal, and that means not just equal in privileges, but also equal in wealth. Well, that's an impossibility, as you all know, that if I gave every one of you $1,000 at the end of the month, some of us would have a couple and some would have nothing, you know. I mean, that's just human nature. Some people know how to save and other people know how to spend. And so one of the ways of equalizing people was to, with this tax situation, and they levied the taxes much like, I was thinking of this the other day, much like we did when we built our church in Reedley. We assessed people according to what we thought they were worth. Well, that's the way they did it, but they said, well, now, if you have, and they called everybody that was farming, and I'm talking about farmers now because I don't know anything about the business people in that country because we farmed, that if you were set up so that you could operate your farming without depending on neighbors or anything, well, then you were considered rich, and they called you a kulak. And if you were rich, well, then you were supposed to buy $2,000 worth of, give $2,000 to education and buy $2,000 worth of bonds. That would mean anybody that had four horses, because that's what it took to pull a plow or a binder. And if you had a plow and a binder and a drill, and you had the four horses, and you, of course, everybody had the land, why, then you were considered rich. And that would be your assessment. Some people couldn't do that, and some people couldn't. Now, I made the statement that everybody had land because in 1925, the government confiscated all land in Russia. And you did not own anything. It was given to you by the government. First they came in and they confiscated, and then they said, now in your village, for instance, you have so many acres of farming community, there are so many people, so each one of you got 45 acres to farm. That is yours to farm, and there's no strings attached to it. You can farm it as long as you live here, but you can't sell it and you can't call it your own. Well, they gave it out according to families. In our particular case, I was an only child. That is, I was the only one living. I had a brother and a sister that died when they were small. So my dad and mother and I had 105 acres that could farm, and we'd been farming over 1,000. And then there were our neighbors who had never farmed, but they were just working people, and they had 9 children, you see, and there were 11 in the family, and so they had all kinds of land. Now that equalized itself very easily because those people couldn't farm their land. So they came to us and they said, look, if you give us a little bit of rental each year for this, then you can farm this just as though it was your own. And so the people that were ambitious, that were willing, were operating even in a bigger scale after that than they were before. It just doesn't work that everybody's equal. Well, we farmed much bigger after 1925 than we had before. And my dad, of course, having this government position, was home very little because it was more than just looking after these farmers around here. But soon after he had this position, they asked him to do some other service for the government. He was appointed an auditor. I don't know to this day how come he ever received that position, except that it was of the Lord, because it took him away from home. And not that was of the Lord, but it brought him to the city of Omsk, into government contact very frequently. And it also gave me an opportunity to spend a lot of time in acting as a taxi boy for these fellows, because I wasn't going to school and there wasn't the work in the winter time on the farm, as we had a hired man to take care of the cattle. And so it gave something to do for me, and it gave Dad a lot of good contact with people in the government. During those 25, 26, and 27, thousands and thousands of, especially Mennonite people, left Russia because of what they were afraid was coming, and went to Canada. Some of them went to England. Some of them went to Germany. A few of them went to South America. And all of my relatives were all set to go to Canada. They always kept poking away that they wanted to move to Canada. As a matter of fact, all but two of my uncles sold everything that they could sell and had papers worked out so that they could go to Canada. And they worked on my dad real hard to go, but my dad always said that he didn't care to make a move because he didn't want to start out working for someone else when he was able to have someone else do the work for him. He thought that he would stick it out if he possibly could. Well, 1927, government finally realized what was happening, and they just canceled all passports. And since 1927, no one has left Russia legally. They've closed all immigration doors, and they have left no one out. Of course, that actually didn't bother my dad at all, because he didn't want to go anyplace. But in 1926, they came out with their final books that they were going to use as textbooks in school. And of course, that again was my dad's job to make sure that this thing was coordinated between all of these communities. So he went to the city to pick up the books, and he brought them to our house. And in the fall of that year, when he brought the books, one of the first boxes he opened was the book that was to teach us the history of man. And it was a big black book, about as big as that Bible over there. And on the front of it cover was a picture of a black monkey, and underneath it said, "This is your ancestry." You can imagine the reaction in a Christian home to that type of a textbook. And it was right there and then that my dad says, "You're not going to school." And and we're not going to do anything about these things. But of course, the government came in and insisted that they use these textbooks. The teacher that we had was a Christian man, and although we distributed the books, they were underneath the desk most of the time, and the only time they ever came in the foreground is when there were strange people in the area that no one knew who they were, and we thought that they might be inspectors. We kept on using the old textbooks that we had been using, but that was one of the ways that they were going to get in. And of course, the communists have been very, very smart, and that is that they've provided a lot of work for kids. All of their education after the first few years was with children. They didn't care much about the old folks. They knew they couldn't change them anymore, but they went after the kids. And all of their programs was for athletics, like playing soccer and playing football and playing tennis and swimming and programs like Boys and Girl Scouts all over the countryside. Everywhere they were promoting them in order to get at the youth. And that's, of course, why they wanted to have control of education, because they wanted to teach communism the way they wanted taught. After my dad kept me out of school, and I was more or less just running around, like I said, hauling government officials around, and he became busier and busier with this, he realized that we were being protected from a lot of these communistic persecutions because of his office. Because in 1927, the first thing in January they did was they declared officially all these people that were kulaks, or that they considered rich, as having no more right to vote or citizenship. And when they did that, they automatically confiscated half of everything they had. And in our village, there were three families that they did that to, and we were in that category, but because of my father's position, they didn't do it to him. They came in and they took, if he had four horses, they took two. If he had two sleds, they took one. If he had two pieces of equipment that were alike, they took one. If he had four cows, they came and took two. And nothing this fellow could do about it. They just confiscated, and that was it. Then they also prohibited all establishment of new worship places. We could still have church in the church that we had, but no new ones could be established. We couldn't start any new services. If we hadn't been meeting on Wednesday night, we couldn't start meeting on Wednesday night. We could keep what we had, but there was no expansion. Of course, we realized that if they started that, then pretty soon they would start curtailing, which they did very soon. The fact that there was very little decent order law also made my father wonder whether it wouldn't be a good thing to move someplace where you weren't known, because regardless of how good you are, you're going to have enemies, and when there is no way to be protected, those enemies can do almost anything they want to you, and there's nothing you can do about it. So my dad in 1927 began to wonder whether we shouldn't move to another location, staying in Russia. And so it was that he began to look around, and the government was opening up a new farming community near Vladivostok, which would be a couple of thousand miles from us, and then we would be in a completely new country. And Dad was interested, and so Dad and Mom started praying about it. And the Lord opened up in a wonderful way that we were able to sell everything that we had, the home that we had, all of the cattle that we had. A fellow came from the southern part of Russia, and he wanted to live in this community, and he was a nice chap, and he had the money. He bought our home, and we introduced him to all the neighbors, and they all voted. They had a community meeting and voted that they'd let him live in the area and farm the land that we had, buy our home. And so after they voted, we sold him everything that we had, had an auction to sell the horses and the cows and the implements and what we had. And then Dad and Mother and I and one of my uncles with his family, moved to Blagoveshchensk, which is a very small town on the Amur River, which is the boundary between Manchuria, China, and Russia. We moved there in the fall of 1928. We were to farm. We had all intentions of farming over there. We'd looked over the land, but when we got there, the Amur River had overrun its banks that year, and it had flooded all that farming country. And my dad saw that. He said, I don't want to live here where it's like this. And we could also look across the river into China, because that river was just a very small river. And we soon met some people that just got it, went across that river very frequently, and they could talk about the conditions in China, how wonderful it was, and how free trade was, and opportunities, and we began to wonder whether it might not be a good move for us to go to China. China has an agreement with Russia that anybody that came there, they would not send them back, but that they would let them stay there. So if we got into China, we were not afraid that we'd be sent back to Russia. So we began to think about going to China. My dad made another trip back home to see his parents, my grandparents. And when he was back there, things had changed so much in about 3 months that he was really happy that we had moved, and that he was more determined than ever that we should get out of Russia, because things were really clamping down fast in the education and also in the way that they were permitting them to have church and propagate the gospel. So we met a young fellow that was making his living going to China, buying ladies' silk hose, which you couldn't buy in Russia, pocket watches, which you couldn't buy in Russia, and wrist watches, and those small things that are not bulky, and he would go into China and buy them, come into Russia and sell them on the black market, and when he'd be short of money, he'd go back to China and buy some more. And the government was patrolling the river by having stations set up every few miles, lookout stations, and they'd have a man on horseback riding between these lookout stations about every 2 hours in order to catch these people as they would come across, and they'd take the things away from them, and sometimes they'd put them in prison and sometimes they wouldn't. Well, they'd caught this fella twice, so he was beginning to get scared that if they'd maybe catch him again, they'd put him in jail or put him away. And so he was not too anxious to go back to Russia, to China, to do this. But he was well acquainted over there, and so my dad, as he contacted him, discussed with him the possibility of helping us get into China. And so he made another trip to China, this fellow, across the river, and investigated the possibilities of us going there and maybe living, or at least temporarily being there. He went over there and he found out that for 50 Chinese dollars, which would be 100 Russian rubles, we would be able to buy Chinese citizen papers when we got there, so that we could freely move in China. And that this fellow would, the man that was going to do this for us, would take care of us for a while and see to it that we would be put up and all. And so we were looking for an opportunity to cross the river. This was in the fall of the year, 1928. We knew that in the wintertime the river would freeze over good and solid, and that would probably be the easiest time to cross rather than to do it in the summertime. And so we made ready to cross the river in December. We bought a horse and a sled, and my uncle bought two horses and sleds, bought some shovels and forks and buckets and things to make it look like we were going farming rather than trying to do anything else, which had nothing to do with our crossing the border. Put those on, the sleds, and sold everything that we had except the bare minimum of things, due to the fact that we knew in Russia these things were very scarce. When we got into China, or we hoped to get to Canada someday, why, we would be able to buy anything because everything was plentiful there. And so we started out early in the morning in December, the 23rd day of December, and 1928. We got out of town just as sun came up. We just figured that it would be just a simple matter to cross that river, because you could see across the river and you could see the people and you could see the streets and everything, a matter of 10 minutes and we'd be across. But we hadn't counted with the fact that for some reason or other these people would be patrolling that river that day, at least in a very special way. We hadn't been out of town half a mile, and here was this, we thought, well, we'd just go across the river, and here was this fella on horseback with a machine gun patrolling the river. He was sitting in the bushes that morning. Somebody saw him accidentally, actually. If we wouldn't have seen him and they would have turned across, of course, that would have been the end of the men folks, and we don't know what they'd have done with the women. But the Lord made somebody see this man in the bush. And so we kept on going down the river as though we were going down to this farming community, which was about 20 miles down the river. But of course, we wanted to go across. We couldn't find a place to cross the river after that for a long time. And then until about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we still hadn't crossed. And we knew that that time of the year, it gets dark over there around 4. And so we had to get across now or we'd have to spend night somewhere. So we picked out a spot that looked quite feasible. We rechecked the harnesses on the horses. And we had a little baby along one of my cousins. How old was Johnny? 6 weeks? 6 weeks old, this little fella, and he was bawling, and we were all paying attention to him, and had everything set to go across down onto the river and across, when we noticed that this fella on horseback was in back of us with a machine gun, and he was coming right behind us just as fast as that horse would go, and so we figured, well, boy, somebody squealed on us somewhere down the line, as much as we try to keep it a secret that what we were doing, but he didn't even act as though he saw us. When he came up behind us, he just went by us and kept going just as fast as that horse would go. And as soon as he was out of sight, we knew that normally there wouldn't be another fellow coming for a couple of hours, so we would have a good chance to get across without being bothered. So as soon as he was away, while we turned down onto the ice, we hadn't figured with the fact that where we were now, the river was much narrower, but it had been deeper, and the ice was piled up in great big chunks, high as the ceiling, standing straight up like this. And it wasn't smooth, and there was just no way to get across. So we drove along the bank of the river, down in the river, but on the side, and we couldn't find a place to get across. We were off the road, and we went down that way for a while, and finally we found a place where one of the horses figured, I guess it could go, at least they started off and across this rough ice, and everything went off the sleds, all our baggage and everything that we had, and instead of it just taking 10-15 minutes, we had to work with the horses because of the deep snow and these crevices. It took us an hour and a half to get across this little strip of ice. But finally we did get across into China, and then of course as soon as we got across we turned around to go back because we wanted to go to this little town that was across the river from Blagoveshchensk, where we live. We stayed in a small Chinese inn that first night after we'd gone backwards about 2-3 miles. It was just a very small building, and it had only one door, no windows. She came into the door, and right in front of it was a great big kettle under which was a fire, and this kettle they used to cook their food, to heat their water, and everything else, and the fire served as the heating for the whole room, and they had a chimney built all along the wall, and it came out by the door, and the chimney was built out so that you could sleep on it, sit on it, and it was a table, the chair, and the bed. And you lay down on it, and you warmed the one side that you were laying on. When the other got cold, that one too warm, or the other too cold, you just turn over. We had just gotten in there, and two Russian soldiers came in, machine guns on their backs. And we immediately, of course, got instructions that we talked only Dutch, nobody speak Russian. And we acted as though we didn't understand them. And of course, they couldn't understand us. And they stayed in this same room all night. And you can imagine there was no sleep as far as we were concerned. Early next morning, therefore, we harnessed the horses and we started for this town of Sakhalin. We got there in the middle of the afternoon. This fellow that were to buy our ticket, our citizenship papers, was a hotel keeper, and so we stayed in his hotel, and 3 days, we were all Chinese citizens. There were 17 of us all together, counting this little baby. So now, of course, we didn't want to stay in Sakhalin. We wanted to go to Harbin, which is an international city, and it was 500 miles across the plain and across some mountains, and no roads. And it was in December, there was 40 below zero many times, and lots of snow. We found a fella that had a 1927 Rio bus that he figured that he could get us there because of the fact that everything was frozen over, and he says, we have marks along the road, and he said, we'll get you there, it'll take a week, 7 days, 500 miles. You take enough food along for 7 days, and he says, we'll get you there. So we hired this bus driver. He put 5-gallon cans of gasoline all over the top of that bus, had them laying there, clear full. That was for the fuel for the transportation. pile us all in there. We had enough food along for a week. And we started off, and that was the first time I found out that you could get seasick on a car, driving in a bus. It was really pathetic. No roads. And we traveled for 7 days before we came to the railroad station, which was just a short ride from Harbin, and he put us on the train there, and then we went from there to Harbin, China. We arrived in Harbin, China on Christmas Day. And the reason for that is that in Russia we have different dates than they do here. See, 14 days difference. So we'd been chasing around for 16 days, and then we still got to Harbin, China on Christmas Day, 1928. The Depression had already set in China, and there was unemployment every place, people looking for jobs. Harbin is a very international city. It has a Chinatown, has a American, a little town that's called America, and they've got an English, and they've got a German and sections, and it's a real large city, very modern. Even in 1928, they had a lot of cars, all taxis, of course. They had in their big department stores, you paid the girl the money, and she put it in one of these things like JCPenney's has, and gives it to the Yank, and the money goes up to the cashier. And, I mean, as far as we were concerned, that was really terrific, because in Russia, you didn't have those kind of things. Buying and selling over there was a real problem. When you went to buy something, you had a little book like this. And when you bought 10 pounds of sugar, they'd put down on October the 13th, Pete Funk bought 10 pounds of sugar, and he bought 5 pounds of apples, and he bought a pair of shoes. So next time you go in, you want to buy something, the fellow looked at your book, and he said, now look, you haven't used this thing. There's only 3 in your family. So you haven't used this yet. You can't have sugar, or you can't have shoes, or you can't have apples. And so black market was really thriving. And I remember many times in the last few months that where we had nothing of our own, or we had to live from bought things. I've gotten up at 2 o'clock in the morning and stood in the line from 2 in the morning till 10, 12 daytime to get a loaf of bread. And then when we did get it, it was such that we couldn't even eat it and throw it away. And that was black market, of course, not the regular channels, but that's the only way you could get something extra to eat. And things were really rough. Well, when we got to Harbin, China, this unemployment situation, we had no idea. But we soon found out. We rented a little house to live in, and then it didn't take but a week, and we found out that the citizen papers that we'd bought from this man didn't mean anything except that as long as we stayed in China. They were not recognized by any other governments. And so we were people without a country, actually. We had hoped that we would, as soon as we got into China, we'd be able to go to Canada, because we had a lot of relatives there and friends. But the Canadian government said, nothing doing. You have no place that we could deport you to if you were the kind of people that were undesirable after you came here. Germany said the same thing. Japan said the same thing. We tried one. Argentina said the same thing. Well, we never even thought of the United States of America, because that actually was just like a little heaven as far as the rest of the world was concerned, because that's where money grew on trees and everybody had money and everybody was rich and everybody was honest. Actually, that's what the people think, because for instance, lost my wallet on the street, I didn't need to worry. Somebody'd pick it up and turn it into police, and I'd get it the next day, and I'd have my money. You didn't have to lock your house. Nobody stole, and everybody was honest. And all of those things. Well, one of the reasons that people believe that money grew on trees, because America did a terrific amount of good in Europe right after the war. For instance, I know that we, in our neighborhood, we never needed to use it, because the Lord always provided, had so that we never were dependent on other people. But there were kitchens, soup kitchens, whatever you want to call them, set up where people would get food and would get clothing. And our neighbor, for instance, had a brother that lived in Dinuba, California, which is just 6 miles from Reedley, where we live now, which at that time didn't mean anything to us, but it became quite important since. But he used to send him cash in a letter. He'd write him a letter, and this brother, who was our neighbor, was a sickly man, and he was very poor, and he would write to his brother and tell him how tough it was, and next month he'd get a letter, and there was a $10 American money in it, or a $20 bill in it. And you know, people to do that, we figured they really must be rich over here. So not just we, but everybody. Well, this And this, just will bring this in now, because this was a real provision of the Lord. This, it was completely illegal to have foreign money in Russia. And so this neighbor would get this money from America, from his brother, and he couldn't do anything with it. He couldn't even tell anybody that he had it, because it was illegal. And so he had this good money, and he couldn't buy anything with it. And one day he confided in my father that he had this money. And of course, my father knew that it was illegal for him to have the money, too. But he made him a deal. He says, if you will promise that you'll say nothing, and if you do, he says, I'll just turn you in. We're both in trouble. I'll buy this from you for the legal exchange, which at that time was 2 Russian rubles for 1 American dollar. And so as this fellow would get these American dollars from his uncle, from his brother here, my dad would buy them from him. And we had accumulated 300 of those American dollars over a period of time that had been sent to this man, which my dad had, and which, of course, was a military secret. Later on, you'll see how the Lord wonderfully used this. We came into China then, as I said, we could go nowhere. And we couldn't stay in China because money we had very little of. The fact that we came into Russia, into China illegally, we couldn't change our money legally either. Nobody would. So we had to change it illegally, and which meant that we had to pay 6 Russian rubles for 1 American dollar, even though the legal exchange was 2 to 1. So we just lost half of everything that we had by the exchange. As we were wandering around China to wonder what we're going to do in this Harbin, my folks noticed a sign over a business office which said, John J. Isaac, optometrist. My dad says, John J. Isaac, that's the doctor that brought you into the world. Let's see if it's the same one. It's the same name. So they went into this man's office, and sure enough, it was the doctor that had delivered me when I was born. He'd fled Russia when the communists came in. We never knew where he was. When he came to China, he decided he'd rather be an eye doctor than a medical doctor because the Chinese wearing glasses designates prominence, and so every Chinese that can possibly afford to wear glasses buys them. So he became wealthy as an optometrist. And of course, he was real thrilled to see my dad and mother because they'd grown up together in the old country as kids, and he'd been our family doctor until he left. Of course, he was very anxious to know what we were doing, how we got there, and all of these things. And after we told him our plight, and he told this story to the American consul, who was a personal friend of theirs. And the American consul told him that there might be a chance for us to come to the United States under an immigration law which permitted a certain amount of Chinese farmers to come to the United States. He suggested that if we knew anybody in the United States that might contact the government in Washington, D.C., that there would be a good possibility to work it out. So he wrote from Harbin, China to Washington. We had a man who had been in our home in Russia that lived in Kansas, who was the head of the Mennonite Central Committee, which is an organization that does relief work all over the world for the Mennonites and the Quakers. And we knew this fellow, and so we got in touch with him, and he made a trip to Washington. That was in 1929, the beginning of 29. President Herbert Hoover was the president. And so he went in to see Mr. Hoover personally. He arranged a personal interview and told him about our plight, where we were from, and all of these things. And then Mr. Hoover told him, he said, I would love to do something for those people, but you know the depression is on. Labor just absolutely refuses to let anyone come in anymore into this country. Now, there's only one solution, he says. Mr. Davis, who's the Secretary of Labor, is from Pennsylvania. And you know there are a lot of Mennonites in Pennsylvania. He wants to run for governor next year, so if you can promise him that these Mennonites will vote for him, maybe he'll do something. So Mr. Hoover himself called in Mr. Davis into his office, introduced this man to him, and they talked about it together. Mr. Davis came up with the idea that maybe if they'd let these people in at 15 a month, nobody would know the difference. And that would solve the problem at the other end. And so that's the way they worked it out. So God in his time had a man there from the right state to be the Secretary of Labor in order to work out this deal. And so it was worked out that we would be able to come to the United States 15 a month, 15 people a month. By this time, this was in June, by this time there were about 600 people that had done the same thing that we had done, come out of Russia to Harbin, and so there were a big list of people that wanted to come. And of course, 15 a month would take quite a while. So they set up the organization to bring these people over here. But they were, most of them had nothing, absolutely nothing. When they came to Harbin, China, they were penniless. And one of the provisions was that they had to be able to buy their own fare to San Francisco. And so again, the United States, through this man that went to see Mr. Hoover, the money was collected over here and was sent over to Harbin, China, so that the people that didn't have any money would be able to buy their fare. They had to promise that they would pay it back if they could, but it was not a signed note, so they didn't have to say that it was borrowed, although they had a moral obligation to pay it back to the organizations that sent it to them. And so in August of 1929, the first 15 people left. And since my uncle's family, there were 17 of us in the first group, my uncle's family, that left 14, that was his whole family with this little grandson. And by the way, this little fellow Johnny is real dear to us because we had the privilege of having him in our home for a while when he was a high school kid, and Martha had a real ministry in his life, and today he's a missionary in Peru. So he's real dear to us. Well, the first group left, and we stayed for the second group. So we left in September. We got on a train at Harbin, China, and then were to go to Japan and take a boat to go to San Francisco. And from San Francisco, we were all to go to, now I don't remember whether it's South or North Dakota, but anyway, that's where we were going, to one of the Dakotas, because we were farmers, and that's where there's farming, you see. And there again, the Lord intervened in a wonderful way that we didn't go to Dakota. But when we were on this train to go from Harbin to Japan, it was just before the Japanese took over Manchuria. The railroad belonged to the Russians because that's the railroad that goes from Moscow to Vladivostok through China, you see, and it belongs to Russia. It's their railroad. So they have it manned and they have it policed. It's on Chinese land, so the Chinese have their police. And the Japanese were about ready to take over, so they had their police. So every time you dealt with an officer, you dealt with three. One of the big handicaps, of course, was language, because we could speak German, we could speak Dutch, and we could speak Russian. All of us could speak Russian because in school we had to teach half a day Russian, and most of the help that we used was Russian, so we could all speak Russian language all right. But most of the Japanese couldn't understand Russian, neither could the Chinese. So it was a real problem. So as soon as we came out of Manchuria into Japan, the Japanese officer that took charge, he said, he could speak Russian fluently, and he told my dad that the only way we could go through Japan was to each one of us to be able to prove that we could come back from San Francisco to Harbin, China, if the United States should decide that they didn't want us, either because of physical or other ailments. And then that would mean that everybody of the 15 people there would have to have at least $150, because it's American money, because that's what it took from Harbin to go to San Francisco at that time. None of the people with us had been able to even buy their own tickets. We were the only ones that had enough money to buy our own tickets. None of the others had any money, and that had just drained everything that we had, so we were broke too. And this fellow insisted that we put up the $150. Matter of fact, since they didn't have it, he made arrangements to take us all off at the next station until such time as money could be provided to prove that we could come back. Now my dad thought of this $300 that he'd bought from this fellow in Russia when he helped the man in need. So he took this $300 and he gave Mother $150 and he kept $150, and the Japanese officer counted Dad's $150 and gave it back to him. Then he was satisfied. He says, okay, you can go. While he was counting Mother's, Dad gave me his $150. And when he was through with Mother's, then I gave him my $150, and so he counted mine. While he was counting mine, Mother gave hers to another man, and all 15 of us. Oh, use the same $300. You talk about the Lord not being interested in his children, you just got another guest coming. Because that was a real provision many years before that was made. We had no idea that it was coming. And it was uneventful after this, of course, until we got to San Francisco. We came to San Francisco on September the 29th. We landed there at 4 o'clock in the morning. We were on a Japanese boat and had had rice three times a day and had had rice in China for 9 months before that already. So, boy, we were really sick of rice. And there were some people from the Reedley Church where we live now that were there to meet us at the boat, because the group that had gone before us had, through this man in Kansas, had been met by the church over there. And so we stayed, and these people met us at the boat in San Francisco on Friday morning. Of course, the fact that we were third class meant that we were the last ones off the boat, and we didn't get off the boat till about 3 p.m. Then we had to go to the little island off the shores of San Francisco for a complete physical examination and going over through papers and everything. So all we did is greeted these people and made arrangements for them to meet us on Saturday morning at the pier when we hoped to be cleared. So we got on, took us on a little boat and took us to this little island. And there, for the first time in a long time, we were treated like human beings ought to be treated, even though we didn't deserve it as far as we were concerned. We came to a strange country where we knew no one. Still, when we came there, we had linen tablecloth on the table, white ones. They had silver just like they do on the train nowadays, you know, all forks and knives and spoons. And we had a steak dinner, something that we hadn't had for a long time. We had clean white sheets and everything on our beds. We really felt like, boy, you people are really welcome. And it was a wonderful feeling to come to a new country. We could not speak the language, to a strange country, and to be received like we were received. After the routine examinations the next morning, we were all taken back to San Francisco, and then these people met us. And I was separated from my father. I was just 15 years old. Yeah, 15. I just had my birthday in Honolulu. And I was separated from my father, and I went with an old gentleman who had three children with him, two daughters and a boy, and they were all in their 40s. We got one of those red streetcars to go out of San Francisco to Oakland, and then at Oakland they had their car, and we got on the car to drive to Reedley, which is about 200 miles from San Francisco. There's no Model T Ford. And, of course, I spoke German, Dutch, and Russian, and so I tried all three languages on those people, and I couldn't get anything. And no one told me that they were all deaf. They couldn't hear a thing. So I had a miserable ride to Reedley that night. We got to Reedley about 11 o'clock at night. The father of this family took me upstairs in the second floor and into a room where I was to stay. And then Sunday morning, that was Saturday night, Sunday morning early I got up to see whether my dad and mom were. You see, I had no idea that we lived we're out there by ourselves on a farm. I walked outside and I couldn't see a house either direction. Just kind of wondering where I might see Dad and Mom. Well, we had breakfast, and then Sunday morning we all went to church. And of course I knew that I would meet Dad and Mother there. One of the things that we had done before we came to this country, all had our hair shaved off because we wanted to make sure that there would be no lice or anything so we could come in. And I was just as tall as I am now. I only put on a little weight. And had my hair shaved. I wore a gray suit, a red, white shirt, red tie. And came into church, and I sat down. I didn't sit with my dad and mother, but I sat down in the church. And the preacher that morning asked all of those who had just come from Russia to stand up. Which even that had a good point in it, because we all stood up and the congregation looked around to take a look at us. And my father, when we landed in San Francisco, made this statement. He says, now we're going to make this country, we're going to adopt this country as ours, its customs, its language, and you are going to school. I hadn't been to school for 3 years. And he says, you're going to school. He says, I'll have to work in order to make a living. with my hands because I'm too old to do anything else, but he says, you're not going to if I can help it. And so Monday morning, that was, school had already started, of course. My dad took me to school at a little before 8 o'clock, and I had on my gray suit and a white shirt and a red tie. And the place where my folks stayed was just two houses away from the elementary school in Reedley, which goes through the first six grades, and he figured that was a good place to start since I had had 6 years of elementary school training. So he took me over there and dropped me off, and he says, you go to school. Well, there I stood on his corner. I knew no one. And I couldn't speak any English, and so a young fellow that had seen me stand up in church Sunday morning, of course, knew who I was, I mean, at least where I was from, and so he came up to me in a very broken German, asked me what I wanted, and so I told him that I wanted to go to school. So he took me in, introduced me to the principal of the school, who was a good Swede by the name of Johnson. And he told him what I wanted, where I was from and everything, and so Mr. Johnson told him to tell me to sit in the back seat in the sixth grade, and so I sat down in the back seat in the sixth grade, and he came back there, and together we solved a couple of problems. One of them was the fact that I didn't need the smallpox vaccination because he looked at me and he realized that I had had them, and then he wrote some things on paper and gave them to me, and I took them to this fellow, and we found out from that he wanted to know where I lived and how old I was and all of those things. When I went out to play at the recess, we went out to play ball, and at that time the kids played soccer, and of course, boy, that's all we played in Russia, soccer, and I was a foot taller than all the rest of the kids, and so I could really play soccer, and so I became the hero for the kids. And that night I got my mother to go to town with me and bought me some overalls so that I would look like the rest of the kids. And that was on Monday, and on Friday we played the school across the tracks and for the first time beat them for a long time, and I was the hero because I was big and even though I couldn't speak. And so the kids, and you know, of course it was a novelty, here was this fella 5'10 in the sixth grade and or 5'11. No hair on his head. And that wasn't only true in school, but in church, and my wife was one of them. The kids used to get around me, you know, and then they'd try and have me say something in English, and then I guess I'd twist it all up, and they'd just laugh and really have a good time. But with the Lord's help, and certainly not my own, because I didn't work on it that hard, but everybody in the community wanted to help me get going, and so every place I went, people would take the pain to have me help me pronounce.